I'm Joyce Hornady. You might say accuracy is my business. I make bullets.
You are listening to the Hornady Podcast.
Thanks for joining us and enjoy the show.
Hello, everybody. Thanks for tuning in to the Hornady Podcast. I'm your host, Seth Swerzik, and today a special guest in the studio, Mark Keefe. Mark, thanks for coming on the show.
No, thanks for having me, Seth.
Yeah, and thanks for coming to not just the Hornady Podcast, but Hornady as a whole. We were visiting before we started recording that I remember seeing you on the History Channel growing up, and I always enjoyed watching the History Channel. They had some awesome shows on in the early 2000s, mid-2000s, and it's just cool to, one, have you in the studio on our podcast, but you haven't been to Hornady HQ in maybe a couple decades?
Yeah, almost, right? So, you know, we started Rifleman TV in 2002, and we did some early episodes, and, you know, of course, friends with just about everybody here.
Right.
But often when we're doing a show with Hornady, I know the people here. I know the quality of experience that they're going to have, and I know that they're going to learn by watching how you guys make bullets, how you guys make cartridges. So it's been my guys coming to see it, the staff editors of American Rifleman, not me, and I feel bad about that. I love the people, and I love the place, and I love what you guys do here.
That's awesome. So in 2002, very different Hornady manufacturing compared to 2024. What jumps out at you about the facility and, you know, maybe the size of the products that we make even?
Yeah, you know, so you think about that era, you know, you had the 17 HMR was brand new. And you guys, you know, do the bullets for that. But, you know, there was some cartridge development going on. But you look at that timeline, you get things like the 375 Ruger, you get 30 TC Express, you get
RCMs.
Yeah, the Ruger Compact Magnums, one of my favorites, 450 Marlin. And then you guys started on a developmental track that you really have not looked back from, and that's starting with the 6.5 Creedmoor, learning a lot about bullets and cases and efficiencies. And then, you know, you developed the PRC series, 300, 7mm, 6mm, and now the Advanced Rifle Cartridge series. I mean, these really cutting-edge cartridges, and when you think about when this place started in 1949, it was just bullets.
Yeah, and it was in about the size of this room.
Exactly. And no, it's been really an honor to kind of watch the growth of this company and its people and its products.
Awesome. Well, thanks for the kind words, Mark. Now, before we get into today's topic, for the listener that might be unfamiliar with your work, it's really spanned several decades, and I don't know a single person who is more of an aficionado on firearms as a whole. You know, I know a lot of folks that are, you know, they know a lot about World War II era firearms or Vietnam era firearms or Civil War or current or whatever, but I don't know anybody whose depth of knowledge spans firearms as a whole, like as a thing. And that's pretty remarkable. So if you would, let's briefly talk about, you know, maybe what got you into firearms,
sure,
where that started, and then from your professional career, as I know it, mainly with American Rifleman, but then now you're the editorial director for all of NRA publications and American Rifleman specifically. I mean, they've got millions of subscribers out there.
Oh, yeah.
And it's just really cool to have you here. But what got you into firearms
first? Let me say, Seth, you're just not hanging out with the right crowd.
Of course.
You know, I have dear friends, Phil Schreier, director of the National Firearms Museum. We've been friends since 1979. Then Gary James, longtime editor of Guns and Ammo, who's helped us out on TV a lot. There are things those guys know that I do not, but the difference is they're mostly on the history side. You know, Gary James can tell you where a matchlock was made just based on its serpentine, right? Phil
wow.
Schreier can tell whether that Colt's a fake or not from across the room. But I've had to be involved in the firearms industry. I mean, my first job with NRA was a curatorial assistant in our museum, which was, well, more janitorial, to be honest. And then I started as a technical editor, an assistant technical editor on American Rifleman, testing guns, doing dope bag reviews, Q&As, research. And then, you know, 95, I became managing editor, and then 2000, I became the editor. And the thing about American Rifleman is, you're right. You know, you have at times up to almost 2 million NRA members getting that magazine. They don't all want to read about the same thing.
Right.
And so we've always had a history component, a new gun component, techniques. You know, you're trying to have a story that's going to appeal to every single NRA member in your feature well. And if you're going to assign stories and evaluate them, you better know something about them. And I got to tell you, you can get pretty smart reading every issue of American Rifleman for 30 years, five times.
I can imagine
every issue.
That's remarkable. And so working as the editor for American Rifleman, and then I'm going to say recent years, because it has been somewhat recent, the editorial director for all of NRA publications.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. Considered myself a Rifleman guy for most of my life. And then John Zent, my dear friend, retired as editorial director. I took over. And now I've got America's First Freedom, our political magazine, Shooting Illustrated, our hip young new shooter magazine, American Hunter, American Rifleman, NRA Women, NRA Family, Shooting Sports USA. And the thing that impressed me most is just the quality of our magazines, the quality of our websites. Because to be honest, if there's a story in Hunter I wanted to read, I'd read it. But I didn't read every word. Now I get to read every word.
Right.
And, you know, the quality of the NRA editorial staff, second to none.
Agreed. Yeah, awesome stuff. And it, kind of a peek behind the curtain of where you started to cultivate this firearms knowledge. I'm guessing a firearm enthusiast your entire life.
Yeah. And a history guy.
Yeah, for sure.
So, started off shooting. I remember when my cousin Bob handed me the first Thompson I fired. I think I'd helped with some fences or something. He's like, said to my uncle, he's like, "Hey, Mark, he's scrawny, but I think he's big enough for the Thompson, you know?" And so, you know, did some shooting, Boy Scouts. And then once I got into college in particular, I really took a deep dive on guns. And, you know, when I got out of college, I was working three jobs just so I could buy more guns.
Yeah, that sounds like a story I think a lot of us are familiar with.
Yeah.
A lot of our listeners for sure.
Yeah, absolutely.
So let's transition now into the topic. And this topic is something that if the listener wants more information on, you wrote a story about this and it's available at American Rifleman's website.
Yeah, AmericanRifleman.org.
.org. So we could probably get a link to that, but it's 10 rifles that shaped America.
Not just rifles.
Oh, 10 firearms, excuse me.
Yeah, and one of them's not even a firearm, so you can call it 10 guns. You can call it 10 firearms if you want to, but somebody's going to call you out.
Okay, well, it's, 10 firearms, rifles, things that shaped America. And I'm going to, in that piece, you wrote this, and I pulled a couple sentences out that I want to read here, because there's no point in me trying to say this with different words, because this is written really well. And it starts with, "Firearms have been part of this nation since long before it was a nation. And the right to them was endowed by the Creator, and they secured our freedom as Americans." And those are two very powerful sentences. And as it relates to our topic today, this next sentence, "Guns without people are mere objects." And so to tell the story of America and their guns, you paired the gun with a person. And that really does paint a different picture. As a historical enthusiast myself, as a gun guy myself, it's true, you know, and there's a lot of us here that, you know, you might have your grandpa's 30-06 hunting rifle from 1960. Well, there's a lot of 1960 model bolt action rifles in 30-06. They're not important to you unless it was your grandpa. So the firearm without the person is just an object. And so this really does paint a really nice picture. So with that, it appears as you've got these kind of in chronological order, starting with something extremely old. So what's number one on the list?
Yeah, so, and I'm going to have to apologize right off, because some new information has come to light since I wrote this. The National Firearms Museum, of course, is a national treasure, right? It belongs to NRA in Fairfax, and of course, there's Bass Pro Shop. But one of the guns that's always been important, and it's a wheel lock carbine. And so it had provenance ascribed to it that, you know, provenance is you want that direct link. You want to know it was this guy's gun. And so it's a wheel lock carbine, probably has an Italian barrel. The Beretta guys think it's theirs. I don't know. It's got German Swiss lock work, but it's stocked in New England maple. And so the gun was restocked at some point a long time ago. And at first we thought it was John Alden's, and John Alden came over on the Mayflower, and it's a great story, but it's just that. It's without proof. It's just a story.
Okay.
But, you know, were it his, he was in the Massachusetts Bay Militia Company. There were, you know, various squabbles with Native Americans. And so this gun has been in America for a really long time. The lock work, it actually indicates that it's a little later than 1620. But you have to remember, Pilgrims came in to Plymouth in 1620. They weren't the first European settlers here. You had the Spanish and that sort of thing. They keep finding Spanish cannons in the desert. But one of the things that predates, you know, the colony in Massachusetts was Jamestown in my native Virginia in 1609. And the thing about Jamestown is, you know, you have the families and the religious aspect of the Pilgrims. These people came to Jamestown because they wanted to get rich. They wanted to make money. They were typically young men. And they weren't as affluent because a matchlock is really expensive. It's like buying a clock, a Zippo lighter, and a gun all in one package. And you have to be able to make all those things and make them work together. So they were mostly using matchlocks. And if you've ever lit off fireworks on the 4th of July with a punt, with the matchlock, imagine having one of those right next to your face.
Right next to your face.
And it's popping and it's smoking. And so it's not like a trigger with a sear. It's a serpentine and you pull it and it goes shoomp and it sits in the gunpowder in the pan and then goes woof right in your face. And it was the predominant military firearm in that era. And we don't know of one that came from Jamestown because most of the people there died of scurvy, malaria, and everything else. Yeah. It was a really horrible
dysentery
place to live.
Yeah.
So we don't have a gun ascribed to that, but we know they were there. And we know that the Pilgrims had both matchlocks and probably Willocks.
That's remarkable. So it may not have been John Alden's specific Wheelock, but it is a Wheelock that has been in this country since well before it was an official United States.
Yeah. No, this gun, who knows exactly when it came to America, but it's been here a long, long time. And that New England maple really gives it, you know, that provenance. Because, you know, if the gun came from Germany unmodified, why would it be a New England maple? Where are you going to get New England maple?
Not in Germany.
Not in Germany. Yeah.
Right.
And there wasn't a Germany yet either, but that's another story.
Another story. Again, a cool firearm and just a cool piece of history. Again, regardless of who it belonged to.
Right.
Just its age. Is really neat. So moving on to number two, we have Captain John Parker's musket.
When hunting the wild, challenges abound. Leave nothing to chance. 7mm PRC from Hornady.
Yeah, so this one, no doubt about the provenance, right? Because this gun was donated to Massachusetts State by the grandson of Captain John Parker, the Reverend Parker. And literally it says, this firearm was used by Captain John Parker at the Battle of Lexington, April 19th, 1775.
Wow.
So John Parker commanded the militia company of 77 men that fired the shot heard around the world on April 19th, 1775. So a little background, right? So here we are in 1775. Boston Massacre, 1770. Towson Act, Stamps Act, Intolerable Acts. 1770, 1775. Nobody's fighting. Nobody's shooting at each other yet. So what happens is General Gage, the administration was getting really concerned about the colonists and their militia companies, and they didn't know where this was going to go, so they sent Lieutenant Colonel Smith and Major Pitcairn, Royal Marine, to Lexington and Concord to seize all stands of arms, cannon, powder, you know, anything.
They wanted.
Yeah, and, you know, you got the Midnight Ride of Paul Revere and all that, alerting the colonists that the British were coming. And so a column of about 700 redcoats sets out, and they're met on Lexington Green by these 77 militiamen led by Captain Parker. A lot of the men there that day were actually relatives of his. And then Captain Parker told his men, stand your ground. Don't fire unless fired upon. But if they mean to have a war, let it begin here.
Wow.
Nobody knows who fired that first shot. But what I will tell you is the Redcoats got into trouble because as more militiamen came, these Redcoats had to get out of there, and eventually a relief column came, but they were shot at, sniped, and this is just this running gun battle, pretty much halfway back to Boston.
Wow.
And then after that, of course, the Siege of Boston, the colonists basically cut off Boston and besieged it. And eventually the British had to leave. So this is, I mean, really the first shot of what I'd like to think is modern American freedom, you know? And nobody wanted a bloody war. But the reason there was a gunfight was because the British were coming for our guns. They did all these terrible things to the people in the colonies, but it didn't turn into a war.
Until they came for the guns.
Until they came for the guns.
Well, that I'm got goosebumps just talking about it. It's remarkable. And to have that piece of history, like you said, with the direct tie.
What's even funnier, this is an incredibly important American artifact. So it's got British and Dutch parts. It's 62 caliber. It's got no bayonet. It's not quite a Fowler, but it's not, you know, that's one of the problems. A lot of colonists didn't have bayonets. But with the craziness in Massachusetts, hanging up there, you can't get to it without a ladder.
Oh, it's hanging up above in,
yep,
in a building.
Yeah, yep, in the state house. They put a trigger lock on it. An unloaded musket, arguably one of the most important guns in all of America. Unloaded, but no, trigger lock. Got to have it. Welcome to Massachusetts.
Wow. Well, I hope somebody had enough wherewithal to...
Yeah, I don't think it's up there for a while, but I've seen a photo of it, and I'm like, are you kidding me? And it's not even a nice trigger lock, right?
The world we live in. an amazing piece and such an important piece of our history as a whole, and that's a very unique point, Mark, that with all the taxes and all the stuff that was put on them, they got by. But when they said, we're coming for your guns, they postured up, and you had 77 of the bravest men on the planet that said, come and take them.
Yep, and they were joined by hundreds of others till the British realized, this is not going well.
I like it. Right, moving on to number three, you have Timothy Murphy's long rifle.
Yeah, so a long rifle, you know, people call them Kentuckys or Pennsylvanias, but really call them a long rifle because they came from Virginia and they came from all over. But essentially, it's a flintlock rifle. You know, started with Jaeger rifles coming over from Central Europe, but they were shorter, thick, heavy barrels, and this unique American art form. It's really a piece of Americana. Very long barrels, typically smaller calibers, 45 or so. Great sight radius. And, you know, they're engraved with patch boxes and that sort of thing. So when the unpleasantries started with the British in 1775, Daniel Morgan, a veteran of the French and Indian War, led a company of riflemen up to the Siege of Boston. And they proceeded to, you know, shoot British guys with rifles. You know, the standard firearm is a smoothbore musket for military use at this time. It's flintlock, right? And the bullet has to be undersized, go down the barrel. Beyond about 60 yards, you know, you're just going to be unlucky, right? I've fired them out to about 100 and, you know, maybe.
Yeah, right? Varying mixes of success.
Yeah. So, but with a rifle, of course, the barrel's rifled. And, you know, you take and put a patch, typically leather or cloth. And when you drive that thing down, you are engraving the rifling onto the patch and the projectile. And I fired period long rifles, you know, out to 400 yards. Not a big deal.
Wow.
You know? Well, you got to do the drop, right?
Which is like a stone.
Yeah, and having a good trigger helps. And then you have, with flintlock, you have some follow through.
Yeah, all follow through.
So so there's the Siege of Boston, and eventually General Burgoyne takes his British army up to divide the colonies. They wanted those rebels in New England separated from New Yorkers and Marylanders and everybody else. And a big battle breaks out at Saratoga in October 1777. And so it's a series of battles, Bremen's Redoubt, but there's a British officer, Simon Fraser, Brigadier General Simon Fraser. And at one point in the battle, it's really, I mean, no one knows which way this is going to go. And so, Daniel Morgan is directed, I think by Nathaniel Green, I'd have to look that up, says, there stands a brave man, but he has to die. And so Dan Morgan, my favorite founding father, buried in Winchester, Virginia, calls over Timothy Murphy, his best shot, and Murphy starts taking shots at Simon Fraser. And it's not entirely clear that he did have an over-under rifle, two rifle barrels, two flints. But it took him three shots at about 300 yards.
Wow.
And, mortally wounds Simon Fraser.
From 300 yards.
Yeah.
Wow.
And The British are forced back, and Burgoyne is forced to surrender. And immediately after that, the entire war changed, because that's when the French came in on the side of the American colonists.
Mm-hmm. Because they didn't like the Brits either.
No, they did not. And it was a very different war. And that French involvement, the funding, the men, guns, really made the difference. It allowed the colonists to just stick it out until, of course, the final British surrender at Yorktown.
Yeah, that is an amazing, you know, with there's so much romanticism about the military sniper, especially, you know, starting in Vietnam to present day.
Mm-hmm.
You've got Timothy Murphy out there at 300 yards, which had to be an unthinkable distance.
No, not for those guys. Right?
Really?
I mean, you know, those backwoodsmen, you know, typically the woods were pretty thick, but it, you know.
They were competent marksmen.
They were competent marksmen. And with an accurate rifle, again, I've done it. And I imagine Timothy Murphy's better at it, you know, then than I am now. But it's possible. Anything that you practice and you're comfortable with.
Mm-hmm.
And it did take him 3 shots.
Yeah. Which is still. There's hunters today that shouldn't be shooting deer at 300 yards.
Maybe. But that one guy in his rifle changed the world.
It changed the world.
You know?
And that's remarkable. This next one that we're moving on to, number four here, this is, I didn't know this was a thing until maybe 5, 6, 7 years ago, something like that. This is so cool. And I'm talking about the Meriwether Lewis air rifle.
Yeah.
That is... For anybody who doesn't know, do some research on this and then fill us in.
Look on YouTube for my friend Phil Schreier. We've done a TV show or two about it, and I've shot a replica of it. But really, it's an Austrian design that was used in the wars against Napoleon. And so this gun, you know, it took him a long time, the Bomford letters, all this stuff, to figure out what kind of repeating air gun it was. They thought it was a British design, but history has pretty much come down on the side of this being a Giardoni. And so it's
Which
got this
sounds Italian.
It does sound Italian.
Not Austrian.
I know, right? Yeah. And it's used to kill Frenchmen. what looks like the buttstock is, it really looks like an eggplant, is actually an air reservoir, and you pump it up like 500 times with this like iron bicycle tire pump, right?
Okay.
And then you can store these containers, and then you screw that on there. And then it's got this magazine of lead balls that runs down the side. I think it's 22 of them. And what you do is you push the breech block over, ball drops in like a pinball machine, right? And drops in there, cock the hammer and fire. And so repeating firearms were very uncommon. But this repeating air rifle, pretty cool.
And quiet.
And quiet. You know, you get the thwack, right?
Right.
You know? And so Lewis took this with him. You know, they also took some probably 1795 rifles as well. But when they'd come upon a village of native inhabitants, they'd be like, hey, welcome to the United States of America. We got our flag, we got our drums, and can I show you my gun?
Mm.
And so he would essentially put on a firepower demonstration, and he bluffed his way all the way across the continent.
Because nobody would, you know, mess with a man with that type of power.
Yeah, no, I mean, maybe they saw a single shot before. Maybe they hadn't, some of these folks hadn't even seen a gun before.
Right.
And, you know, when he's just sitting there going, pink, pink, pink. It had to be terrifying. And they didn't, you know, the people they're running into had no idea how many of these they had. They didn't know there was only one, right?
Could have had a boat full of them.
That's exactly right. And Lewis and Clark, voyage of discovery, going to the, you know, all the way out west.
From coast to coast.
From coast to coast. And bluffing their way across the nation, what would become the nation.
Yeah.
With a big old BB gun.
Wow. That's remarkable. Do you think that was above the speed of sound? Do you think those bullets were supersonic?
Yeah, nah, you know, I'd have, I've shot it. And I think they're close.
Okay.
Wow. So the National Museum of the U.S. Army, thinks they have the one, right? Our museum has, another one. And then a guy named Rick Keller in Chambersburg, Pennsylvania was making these things. And I shot it in his basement, and we're driving through like 2 pine boards with this thing.
Really?
Yeah.
And so you could, for probably some small game, this was a legitimate, you could hunt with it too.
Yeah, no, you could defend yourself. You could, kill Frenchmen, take down, a deer with the right hit. Probably.
Wow.
Just depends on what your penetration is going to be.
And like you said, he charmed his way or bluffed his way or smoke and mirrored his way across the country, running into native tribes that didn't know if he had the power of the creator that gave him this gun or if he had a boat full of them. And that probably disarmed or certainly de-escalated a lot of potential problems.
Yeah, no, a lot of it is attitude. You know, they weren't going in aggressively. You know, they were trying to be friendly and
sure,
but you know,
just in case,
just in case.
That's cool. And again, every single one of these has been very influential. But I mean, you know, for any of the listener out there who hasn't heard of, you know, Timothy Murphy or anything like that, everyone's heard of Lewis and Clark.
Yeah,
and that's pretty cool. So moving on to number five, Samuel Walker's Walkers.
Yeah. So
this is not a rifle. Handgun.
This is a handgun. We got the air gun, so we're really messing this up. No, yeah. I'm just kidding. So Samuel Colt, right? He comes up with the idea from a capstan wheel on a revolver. You had had other repeating firearms, in particular pep box guns, which are a series of barrels and kind of unwieldy, still muzzle loading. Mm-hmm. And so Colt comes up in 1836 with his first Patterson revolver. And so instead of having all the barrels rotate, you just have a cylinder that rotates, and these are cap and ball. You pour powder into each of the chambers, and then you seat a lead ball, and then you put a cap on the back. Mm-hmm. And so it's the better mousetrap. The problem is Samuel Colt was a terrible businessman. And,
good inventor, bad businessman.
At this point, he's a terrible businessman. And so he, you know, does the Pattersons, and there's a Texas Ranger named Samuel Walker that uses Texas Pattersons. Against the Comanche, who are used to single shots. And so next thing you know, you fire your shot, and that's when your opponent would attack.
So ooh, now I got look, five I, more.
Yeah, I got four, at least four more. And so the Texas Rangers loved him. So Sam Colt's company was taken over by his uncle, and Samuel Walker, just in time for the Mexican-American War, becomes the commander of the U.S. Mounted Dragoons. And he writes to Samuel Colt, who at that point, sadly, is selling laughing gas, not making anything except maybe some money, writes to Colt with this specification for a pair of pommel pistols that he wants for two of each of those for his dragoons. And so it's like a 4-pound, 9-ounce gun chambered in .44. And it's the most powerful handgun in the world.
Yeah, especially and if nothing else, it's a hell of a club.
Yes, it is.
Nearly 5 pounds.
So, but Colt doesn't have any manufacturing facilities. So he goes to Eli Whitney, the younger, and says, hey, I have this contract from the U.S. government. I was never able to really get one of these before, but I got one now. Can you help me out here? So what happened is Eli Whitney built the tooling and the initial run of guns. Then Samuel Colt took the tooling and made more guns and the Dragoon and then the, you know, the 1851 Navy, and all kinds of guns. Yeah. So Colt was off to the races.
A huge succession immediately following that.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
For Colt.
And so the guns actually go down to Mexico, and sadly, Captain Walker's killed. I think he's lanced. Mm. Ugh, that sounds grisly, doesn't it?
Yeah.
So, and the guns were taken away, and then they got separated and that sort of thing, but you know, there's only, you know, two guns for each of the Dragoons and then a couple of commercial guns. So this is not only an important gun, the beginning of the real Colt, right?
Mm-hmm. What we associate as Colt revolvers.
Yeah, well, I mean, the Pattersons and all that. But this is the gun that got him back into business. This is that seminal firearm that was the first military contract. And so it's also a very valuable gun for those reasons. And they're frequently faked.
I can imagine they are.
Yeah, and yeah, our museum's got a bunch of them. How many of them are real? That's a question of speculation.
Okay. But still, like you mentioned, obviously for the country, an important firearm.
Oh, absolutely.
Certainly for Texas and that whole area down there. But for Samuel Colt, which, you know, that, you know, Colt is synonymous with
revolvers.
Revolvers.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
that was his saving grace from selling laughing gas to dentists and doctors to
No, it was more of a
recreational thing?
Yeah, afraid so.
Okay. Tough times. So moving on to number six here, this one particularly cool, Abraham Lincoln's Henry Rifle.
Yeah, so the chief of ordnance at the start of the American Civil War was really committed to rifle muskets. And there were more advanced technology. He had Sharps rifles, breech loaders, very accurate. But they weren't interested in that for the main army. So you end up with, you know, like 17 different cavalry carbines used by Union forces during the Civil War, But two really important guns saw very limited use, meaning the Henry, and then pretty common use, the Spencer. And Abraham, people kept trying to go around the ordnance department. It's like, you know what? If we could just get to the White House and show this to Abraham Lincoln, he likes technical stuff, right? Mm-hmm. And so his Spencer and his Henry are in the collection of the Smithsonian. And I think it was in 1863, Spencer came to the White House with this gun. And Lincoln's like, wow, that's cool. Let's go shoot it in the yard.
Great idea.
Yeah, yeah. And he took Stoddard, the Secretary of State, I guess, with him. I think he was state in 63. And, you know, it's said that Lincoln really enjoyed shooting the guns. And so the guns, you know, the Spencer would go on to be used throughout the Civil War. And the Henry, the 1860 Henry, you know, once they got rid of that crazy follower out below the magazine tube in 1866, used King's patented loading gate on the side. It became the 1866 Winchester. So it's inside mechanically, it's the same gun. It's just an improved feeding system. But the fact that you got the President of the United States shooting guns in the backyard, I just think that's cool.
Yeah, or that you could show up to the White House with yeah, right. Look at this gun.
Yeah, not recommended.
Not recommended,
not
no.
Not recommended.
Back then, yeah, an influential figure and obviously a very kinetic time going on in America at that time. And yeah, the Henry rifle and the, like you said, the Winchester that spurred from that, yeah, completely changed the shape of the West, really.
The Hornady Auto Charge Pro. Providing precise, customizable powder dispensing in an easy-to-use, space-saving unit. The new modernized load cell is precise to within 0.1 grain. The AutoCharge Pro offers customizable trickle speeds for various powder types, as well as custom trickle time settings. With a smaller footprint than competing brands, the AutoCharge Pro still offers a large powder capacity hopper. The AutoCharge Pro from Hornady.
Yeah, no, and the Spencer, you know, used self- contained metallic cartridges, 5650. The you know, 44 Henry was initially a rimfire cartridge, but that's metallic cartridges. You guys do that now.
Yeah.
Yeah, no. So it's, you know, bullet, case, primer, powder, all in one thing. You know, you're not muzzle loading. You're not, you know, messing around with the caps. It's all there in one place. Turns out it was the better mousetrap.
And rifle barrels becoming now the standard in that era. So not only you get the metallic cartridge and it's everything self-contained, but the accuracy of the average rifle is just immensely improved.
Absolutely.
All right. Shifting gears now. Number seven, John Parker's Gatlings.
Yeah. So have you shot a Gatling gun?
I have not.
Hmm.
That's just put it on my list of things to do.
Yeah, you weren't raised right, Seth.
Yeah. Not many Gatling guns in central Nebraska.
No, well, there's one in your boss's office. Yeah. I'll leave that where it is. So, you know, Richard Jordan Gatling developed a seed planter. That where he developed this cam system, and eventually he was hoping to make a gun that would end wars, and that's good luck with that.
Yeah.
And so, but he developed what we call the Gatling gun today. And initially it was with cartridges you kind of had to make, but eventually went to 5070, a rimfire, then 4570, and then even into smaller calibers. And so the thing about the Gatling, it's not a machine gun, it's mechanically operated. You crank that thing and you know, the barrels rotate, and then a cartridge drops down, then a striker is pulled by cam, and then it's eventually released at the end of that cam cycle. And you can, as long as you're feeding it ammo and cranking it, it'll just keep going, because this is black powder. And machine guns have enemies. They're called heat and fouling, right?
Yeah.
And so with the separated barrels, depending, you know, 8, 10 barrels, depending, you know, the heat can dissipate. But also all the parts are robust and big and, you know, cam surfaces that have some gaps that allow you to have fouling drop through.
Yeah, and can take the heat a little bit.
That's exactly
absorb
right.
Absorb a lot of the heat.
Yeah, yeah. And so the problem with Gatling guns is most militaries treated them like artillery. Well, give me a Gatling gun and I'll give you a cannon. Gatling gun's going to lose because the cannon can outrange the gun.
Sure.
So, but this guy, a young West Point graduate by the name of Lieutenant John Parker, had this idea during the Spanish-American War. And his idea was not to use Gatling guns for fixed point defense. He wanted the Gatling guns to advance with the infantry and support an infantry attack. And there's four guns, 1040, 1041, 1042, 1043. One of those guns is in the NRA Museum. We know it. We have the serial number. We know this gun was right there on that day. And so they advanced on San Juan Hill. The Buffalo soldiers of the 9th U.S. Cavalry, 9th or 10th, I can't remember which one, and the 1st U.S. Volunteer Cavalry, Theodore Roosevelt's Rough Riders. And as they're advancing on Kettle Hill, the Spanish trenches and blockhouses, Theodore Roosevelt himself, who shot a guy with a revolver on that day, go Mr. President.
Yeah.
You know, he said, we heard this drumming. And then he said, it's our Gatling boys. It's our Gatlings. And the Gatlings were being used to suppress the Spanish.
Keep their heads down?
Yeah. Yeah, no. And Roosevelt also had two 1895 Colt machine guns. Maybe a story for another time. But it was really the supporting fire from those Gatlings that I think allowed those positions to be taken. So without those Gatlings, maybe we don't win that battle. Maybe we get no Teddy Roosevelt. Mm-hmm. We know maybe don't get President Roosevelt and the American century. So pretty important guns.
Pretty important guns.
There's four of them. We know where three of them are. One went to the Philippines and probably didn't come back.
Okay.
But I can take you to one tomorrow.
That is remarkable. And obviously the heroism of John Parker and everybody else involved. Yeah, the Gatling gun. No, I have not shot one. They make them in super small. I think you can get like a 22 long rifle.
Yeah, and they're fun. And but I've fired, these guns were in 30-40 Krag. I fired them 45-70 and 30-40, and I think even in 30-06 because they kept converting them. And it's really fun. The problem is you're going to need some friends because they're heavy.
Yeah, right. So again, if they are that heavy, probably a natural fit. Hey, let's keep these back.
Yeah.
Versus let's move them as we advance with the infantry, but outside the box thinking. And again, some individual acts of heroism, which leads right into our next one with old Sergeant Alvin York and his 1911. This is a super cool story. And when I think, if someone just says, Seth, name a pistol, it's going to be 1911.
Yeah.
Because it is just the iconic pistol in my eyes. So Alvin York and his 1911.
Yeah. So, you know, Alvin York, the Gary Cooper movie, I think from 41, did a really good job of telling his story. Because Alvin York was on set for the whole thing. And he was described by General Jaffa as, you know, having to achieve the most spectacular accomplishment of any private soldier during the war. So here you have Alvin York, and he's a corporal at the time. And they're advancing into the Meuse-Argonne. And this is a really nasty, nasty place. A lot of tangles and ravines, and it is thick in there. And so York's unit is moving forward, and you know this is you know October 18th, 1918. So the Americans are pushing the Imperial Germans, and so they're advancing, and then they capture some Germans, and then the Germans open up on them, and York's sergeant is wounded, and you know he just says, you know what, I'm going to handle this.
Yeah.
And so he sets off with his rifle. His division was issued the 1917 Enfield in 30-06. I was told by two of his sons that he used an 03 Springfield because he didn't like the sights on the Enfield. But anyway, we can talk about that
later. Yeah, that's a debate.
So there was a U.S. military officer, and he liked metal detecting. And people have been trying to find, had been trying to find the site of the York action for a really long time.
Then what era are they looking with the metal detector?
I think about 15 years ago.
Okay. So recent.
Yeah. Recently. Cause you know, you have the maps and everything, you know, people thought it was in this ravine or that ravine. And so I think it's Colonel Massaro. I'd have to, my apologies, Colonel. He and some friends went out, he was stationed over there with metal detectors, and you'd find the typical shell fragments and this, but then one day he started finding little piles of 30-06 brass. Like if a guy were moving alone and engaging German machine gunners, and then moving and engaging more German machine guns. And so it eventually became known as the Sergeant York Trail. And they followed the archaeological evidence of York firing rifles. So, you know, kind of the, you know, and I've walked that ground and I've looked at those ridges, and I think he did a lot of it. He had to stand up. And so, you know, you've got a guy taking 60 to about 110-yard headshots.
Wow. Standing.
Yeah. Standing, yeah. So eventually he's pushing the Germans, and he gets to a point where there's a German counterattack. You know, he's working this way along the ridge, and there's a line of trenches here, and a bunch of Germans come out of this trench. And so he draws his U.S. model of 1911 45 caliber pistol and starts, in his words, ticking them off back to front, shooting the last guy first. So the guys in front have no idea that he's killing all of them.
Mm-hmm.
And so there were some people that were like, is that real? Did that really happen? You know, it's in the movie. Is it part of the, you know, it was in his report. And then eventually these guys with the metal detectors found a pile of 45 ACP brass. There's no other brass. Nobody else is shooting in this area besides Alvin York. And I think the number is 21 or 22 pieces of brass.
Seven-round magazine.
That's three reloads. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. And then eventually, you know, he got his rifle reloaded and he gets up to the top of the trench and a German officer says, are you British? And he says, no, American. And the German officer basically says, look, if you just stop killing us, we'll surrender. You know, and he takes pretty much 140 prisoners by himself.
Wow.
Kind of breaks up that section of line and really just marksmanship, guts.
Guts, courage,
yeah.
Beyond.
Yeah.
Yeah. In the face of nearly definitive death to stand up and do that.
Yep.
Just remarkable. And to have that captured.
I want to know who taught him how to reload like that, right?
So, yeah, that was before the three-gun world. Yeah,
that's exactly right.
That's just great stuff. And again, just get goosebumps talking about a lot of this. Moving in here to another super iconic rifle, Dan G. Turner's, the M1 Garand.
Yeah, Day Turner, right? So you got to think about where the American Army is in January of 1945. So Siege of Bastogne has been lifted, but the Germans are still, you know, they're
doing the German thing.
Yeah. So they advanced into Belgium. And so he was in the 394th Infantry, a sergeant. I think he had been a draftee, right? But he and his men are posted at this little farm complex, a barn, basically. And so Day Turner and his men are there, and they're in the barn. And then the Germans come. And so they use accurate rifle fire to kind of drive them off, but pretty much they start taking casualties. Germans back off, and Day Turner's like, okay, we've got foxholes in the yard. Let's go dig in, right? And so then they mortar the barn, and then Day Turner goes back into the barn, and you can go there to this barn today, and you could see which windows he was firing his U.S. rifle caliber 30 M1 out of. And he basically beat back this German attack by himself. Everybody else is wounded. And sadly, Day Turner is killed 1 month to the day after this action. But he received the Medal of Honor.
Deservedly so.
Yeah, and you can go visit him at the Luxembourg American Military Cemetery. He's still there.
That's, just again, another goosebump type story. And just another story in the infinite pool of stories of the M1 Garand.
Yeah.
And that rifle in and of itself, I mean, present day, the amount of collectors that are, I mean, obviously the CMP program helped a lot, but the amount of collectors that have these and love the history and just to hold one in your hand from, you know, that period is just, you have no idea what that rifle did or where it was, but.
Yeah, no, it was really a remarkable accomplishment. No other military in the world. So it's adopted in January of 1936, and but it's like one of the biggest military secrets ever, right? Because nobody else has the same automatic service rifle that works.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's adopted, but really the rifle that we know and respect and that basically solved the problem of infringing on human freedom 8 rounds at a time was pretty much set by about 1941.
Yeah, just such a cool rifle. So moving on to number 10, and we do have some honorable mentions I want to talk about, but number 10, you have, and I have not heard this story, but the watermelon and coconut rifle.
Yeah. So
jump forward 20 years.
Yeah.
From World War II.
That's the problem. Trying to just pick 10, right?
Yep.
So this gun was made in 1959 by Fairchild. Because you think about the Armalite rifle. You know, what we think of as the AR today, designed by Gene Stoner did the AR-10 and Sullivan, but eventually through a series of events, it gets down to the .223 caliber, and this is a selective fire rifle. The semi-auto only would come a little later, But this gun was built in 1959 by Colt. And so, you know, the serial number 106 was used everywhere. It was the salesman sample of the AR-15. It's a selective fire rifle. There's a picture of it in John F. Kennedy's office. And you know, you have to think that these sales guys were on the road. They were putting out brochures and pamphlets, and they're trying to get sales.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, it went to Southeast Asia and, you know, South America, and eventually serial number 106 became known as the banana and coconuts rifle, because when you're shooting an unstable light bullet out of a 5.56 with a pretty fast twist, you know, it's tumbling and it's going to blow up your coconut for you.
Yeah.
And so it became the banana and coconut rifle. And eventually there's a party on a farm, a picnic, and they invited General Curtis LeMay of the United States Air Force. Of course, bomber guy from World War II. Pretty crusty dude, right? And so they invited LeMay to shoot this thing at 50, 75, and 100 yards. And they put out a watermelon, and he hits it, and the bullet's unstable. It just watermelon everywhere. And they invited him, who was chief of staff of the U.S. Air Force, to shoot the other watermelon. And he said, no, let's eat this son of a beep. And they did. But it resulted in the U.S. Air Force being the first part of the U.S. military to adopt the Colt AR-15 M16 platform. And here we are in 2024.
Still.
Now, the gun has evolved, obviously.
Of course.
But this is the one that set it all in motion. Longest serving U.S. military service rifle. You know, when you think about the Garand, right? It goes from 36 to, you know, when the M14 comes in, you know, in the late 50s. But the M16, it goes from 62 all the way to the present day.
Yeah. Remarkable. And an incredibly well-designed system. And when you've got things... You know, it can run really dirty. I've seen them do that. But yeah, when you got a certain number of things right, you have compatibility where you can just put different parts together. Yep. They function well. They shoot well. I've shot distances with those that, you know, seems pretty far away for a little pipsqueak 223 cartridge.
Well, when you know, I got to tell you, you want to open your eyes about the platform? Shoot the arc.
Yeah, there you go.
I just, you know, I'm like, you got those groups, what? Okay, all right.
Never mind. Yeah, but a great rifle system as a whole that has spanned now many, many, many decades and many military engagements. And then when you open it up to, you know, the commercial side of things, you know, after, you know, in the last 20 years, 25 years, mm-hmm. the civilian market with the builds, they're simple. You got parts availability. Yep. You can do any caliber you want for the most part, any cartridge you want. There's been whole companies founded just on furniture, just on stocks and stuff that go on them.
Yeah, no, and you know, I've used this platform since, I don't even know, you know, 80s, right? Mm-hmm. Shooting, you know, service rifle and then just for fun. And I've seen the transition, you know, from fixed carry handles to flat tops to triangular handguards to glacier guards to, you know, magpole furniture to, you know, collapsible buttstocks. I mean, you know, and then, but the genius of the system is with a couple of tools, you can change everything out yourself. And to be honest, a couple of YouTube videos, right?
So, yeah.
You know, that same semi-automatic action, you know, it just keeps on going.
It just works.
Yeah.
Definitely a rifle or a firearm that helped shape America. And, you know, that gets us from, we're talking into the 1600s, clear to present day. You know, a lot of these rifles had, you know, their military background, and that really did help shape America. But there's an honorable mention on here. You had the Hall.
Yeah, yeah. So
I'm familiar, so fill me in.
So John Hall had a great idea. So, you know, you have this problem, right, where you have a rifle that's really slow to load. You have a smooth
muzzle loader,
and a smooth bore that's slow to load. He came up with a breech loader. And so it's got this little block that pops up, and you put your powder and ball in there and close it, and you put the first of flint, you know, and then cap and ball. And he sold it to the U.S. government. But he didn't just sell that. He sold the idea of interchangeable parts. and he set up the Hall Rifle Works at Harper's Ferry, Virginia. And not only was he going to do this cool breech loader, but he was going to do it so that all the parts interchanged, because with everything up to that point, it might be built to a spec or to a pattern. I don't even know if they use the word spec.
Mm-hmm.
But guns, you know, they still had to be fitted, like to get the lock plate in and that sort of thing.
Hand fit,
yeah. And so this idea of fully interchangeable parts was revolutionary. And sadly, Hall had to fight nepotism and Jacksonian corruption and everything else, but he eventually got it done. And it's a shame, because he died pretty much penniless and alone, a broken man.
Oh.
But he succeeded, and what he did was introduce into the American armory system what we call now the American system of manufacture. So a gun made in Springfield, Massachusetts, at the Army there, and a gun made in Harper's Ferry, Virginia, the parts would interchange. There wouldn't be that fitting. And without interchangeable parts from guns, who knows how much longer it would have taken for the idea of interchangeable parts to catch on. As a matter of fact, guns jump-started the American Industrial Revolution, and it really started with John Hall.
The Hornady Treklite Lockbox XXL. Constructed of an advanced impact-resistant polycarbonate featuring dual 4-digit TSA locks, the Treklite Lockbox offers heavy-duty protection at a third of the weight of steel. The included 1,500-pound rated security cable with patented cable connector maximizes cargo space for up to 2 full-sized handguns. The Treklite Lockbox XXL from Hornady Security.
Wow. So yeah, definitely a worthwhile honorable mention, and a man that had some pretty incredible foresight. And so that was your honorable mention. For my honorable mention that I would like to hear your topic on, we got to go back to John Browning.
Okay.
And a firearm that has you know, a very unique sound. And when you fire it for the first time, it's a mind and body experience. And if you're on the right side of it, it is a very, not soothing, but comforting sound,
sure,
knowing that you got those on your side. I'm talking about the Ma Deuce.
Yeah.
The M2 Browning machine gun.
So, you know, John Moses Browning, greatest American firearms designer ever, right? Kalashnikov once said that he thought Garand was the best gun designer. And he was followed up saying, well, he got it right the first time. Well, John Browning got it right pretty much every time,
yeah,
right? You know, starting with his 1878 high wall, which eventually became the 1885 Winchester. But, you know, he noticed that when he was shooting in Utah, that the grass was moving next to his barrel. And so he's like, huh. Now, the Maxim machine gun came out about 1880, so there's recoil operation out there. And then he decided to tap the gas off the gun, off of a lever action with this thing called the flapper, and eventually he developed his own machine gun. But then as America got closer to being involved in World War I, John Moses Browning decided, you know what? This water-cooled recoil-operated machine gun is something I really need to focus on.
Mm-hmm.
So he developed a gun that we call the M1917, M1917A1, and really just a great machine gun. I mean, I don't know if you've fired a 17A1, but, you know, it's
not.
Yeah, no, it's an incredible gun. It's smaller, it's lighter than other guns. But that same system of recoil operation, that same feed system, after World War One, because they decided that they needed a larger, heavier projectile to shoot down airplanes, to stop tanks, you know.
Battlefield's changing.
Yeah, battlefield's changing. And so the Ordnance Department, by about 1922, had settled on what we call the 50 BMG, 50 Browning machine gun. And initially, it was water-cooled, and then they decided to do the M2HB for heavy barrel. So so it would be an air-cooled barrel, and it's recoil-operated, but this gun could be used in different roles. You know, the Navy, especially like Pearl Harbor, early World War II, they're using M2s that are water-cooled and that are just massive, right? But for vehicles, you know, it was the M2, and also in weapons platoons. You know, so just imagine, you know, not only does some guy get stuck with the 81 millimeter mortar, but then you got to carry the tripod and then
yeah,
the gun and then the ammo on the M2. But it is an incredible piece of machinery. Extremely effective. Obviously, you get the 50 BMG cartridge, especially AP incendiary.
Yeah.
Bad guys don't like that. And so the, you know, there's also the AN-M2, which is used on aircraft. It's got a faster rate of fire. It can feed from either side. But that basic infantry gun, the M2, it's still being used today.
It is.
I mean, tell me a gun that has served for more than a century with only cosmetic changes.
Yeah.
I can only think of one, and it's the M2.
That's pretty remarkable. And you hit on everything that, in my opinion, makes it one of the rifles or guns that shaped America. Was it's on boats for aircraft defense. It's on aircrafts. It's, you know, it's on a T&E, you know, in machine gun positions, sniper applications for those extreme range at, you know, those shots.
Bill Brophy, Jim Land, they can tell you about that. Yeah. Well, Brophy can't, he's passed. But.
It's just remarkable that, like you said, you've got a century of a cartridge and, you know, the M2 being a machine gun. Obviously, you're not using the M2 for sniper applications. You're using the BMG.
Well, I mean, so that's the thing, is that somebody had to do it first, right? And so the 50 BMG round was used by, it's unclear whether it was converted to 50 or it was in 5.5 boys, but the Marine Raiders were using a bolt-action rifle of that type just because M2s were too heavy, because I'm sure they'd rather have an M2, but... Yeah, no, I mean, you know, infantry squads support, you know, just about every American vehicle that had a gun on it during World War II, except mostly Jeeps, but half tracks, tanks.
Yeah.
It gave firepower to our troops, and it still does.
And it still does. So there's 10 rifles, guns, something that shaped America, plus two honorable mentions, and it's hard to pick just 10. Because, yeah, you could probably dive down to several different rabbit holes. But throughout this conversation, Mark, there's been several instances, you know, talking about specifically Alvin York or, you know, some of those more military-esque type stories that just give me goosebumps. I'm confident it's going to affect the listener in the same way. And like I'd mentioned at the beginning when I took that sentence right out of your original posting from this article, that... firearms have been around long before we were a nation, and that they were the right to firearms was endowed to us by our creator, and it secured our freedom as Americans. Just remarkable. And then the way you pair them up with a story and a person, it just brings it to life. So I appreciate that. Now, before I let you go, Mark, every single guest that I have on this podcast, I ask them a pretty weighted question that no one likes to answer. But it's a hypothetical. So, in a hypothetical world, Mark, you've hunted all over the world. If you had to choose one cartridge and one Hornady bullet to shoot for the rest of your life, but you could have an infinite amount of firearms, so different weights and barrel lengths and configurations, but it had to be the same cartridge and the same Hornady bullet, for all you do as a shooter, could you narrow it down to just one?
You know, it's funny, and I might get, I think it was an ELDX or was it DGX. I have a Ruger number one chambered in 300 Win Mag.
Oh, beautiful.
And I'm going to have to, God, you caught me on the spot, because if I just looked at the box that's sitting next to the rifle.
It's an ELDX if it's 300 Win Mag.
Yeah, ELDX. Yep. And, you know, that gun's funny. So it's a number 1S, Ruger number one. And, you know, it's got the express rib, and, you know, it, again, probably not what you want to defend a hearth at home, but for a hunting gun, I like 300 Win Mag. I know it's got a belt. I know it's not as good as PRC and all this other stuff, but that gun shoots really well, with that bullet. And you know, I think about one rifle that if I could only take the one.
Well, you could have any rifle. You have 100 rifles.
Oh, okay.
It's one cartridge, one bullet.
One cartridge. Yeah, so here's the problem. I've shot a bunch of them, and I think the one cartridge, unless I'm getting stomped by elephants, it's got to be 6.5 Creedmoor. It's taken over the world.
Yeah, with a 143 ELDX?
Yeah, no. I mean, it's the one cartridge to rule them all at this point. I mean, you know, the thing about cartridge development is, you tell me what you want to go do, and I'll tell you the right cartridge, and I'll tell you the right bullet. And, you know, except for dangerous game, I would trust that cartridge for accuracy, but also the performance in game of that bullet is phenomenal. You're getting penetration, you're getting expansion, and it's going right where it needs to go.
Yeah, so. The accuracy designed into the cartridge, into the chamber.
Yeah.
So this might be surprise you. You're not the first one on this show to say 6.5 Creedmoor with 143 ELDX.
Yeah. You know, and it's one of those things where, you know, I was aware of Creedmoor when it first came out. And now when people send us guns to test, I'm like, oh, can you just send something besides a Creedmoor? Right.
Right.
You know, because that is what everything is chambered in. And that's for good reason. You guys built a better mousetrap.
Bob, that's appreciate the kind words. And it means a lot coming from you because you have hunted all over the world. You have shot every cartridge out there. And again, that's appreciated. And it, a testament to when Dave Emery and Joe Thielen and the crew here at Hornady, when they designed the chamber and yeah, the cartridge and the case and the dimensions, but when they put that chamber dimension and the specs in there, I've often joked if you had a big enough piece of rebar that you could rifle and get a Sammy spec reamer into, it would probably shoot well. That chamber design just lends itself to whether you buy the really affordable rifle or you have a super expensive custom rifle, they're both going to perform really well. And then with the suite of Hornady bullets and many others out there for that matter, the bullet's going to go right where you put the crosshairs and he's got plenty of power to kill almost anything. Like you said, you know, barring some dangerous game, certainly some range limitations with some bigger stuff like sure. elk, but it's capable. And that's neat to hear you say that. Cause I was, if I have to be honest, I was speculating you were going to say 30-06.
Yeah, no. And to be honest, before Creedmoor, I would have said 30-06, right? It's the most, versatile in terms of bullet weights. And, you know, if you hand load for 30-06, you know, you can do some things with it,
mm-hmm.
but Creedmoor just makes it so easy. And the fact that, you know, when you took it to, the gun companies, you made it easy for them to succeed.
Oh yeah.
And, you know, I have accurate rifles, but you know, an off the shelf Creedmoor will give most of them a run for their money, which is just, you know, hard to swallow.
Yeah. Sometimes it is. Yeah. Awesome, Mark. Well, before we sign off here, people need to get involved and they need to get more information about the NRA, NRA publications. Where should they go for that?
Yeah, so NRA.org is always a safe bet. And then for American Riflemen, it's AmericanRifleman.org. And then just follow the rest of the naming convention, ShootingIllustrated.com, AmericanHunter.org, America's First Freedom. And to be honest, I'll use this as an opportunity. It's an election year. If you love freedom and love guns, you need to be a member of the National Rifle Association.
It reminds me of John Parker's musket. And all right, well, we don't want a war, but if there's going to be one and you're not taking these guns, awesome. Well, Mark, is there anything else you want to leave the listener with about, you know, the top 10 firearms or guns that shaped America?
Yeah. So if you go onto AmericanRifleman.org, we've done videos on a lot of these. We've been to the Battle of the Bulge where Day Turner's action was. We've been to where Sergeant York had his Medal of Honor, you know, action. So we've been to those places, and part of American Rifleman Television is we want to take you places you can't go, whether it's the ballistics lab at Hornady
mm-hmm.
or whether it's Omaha Beach. And so if people like this kind of stuff, American Rifleman is there for you.
Awesome. Thanks, Mark.
Thank you, Seth.
Guys, this was an awesome educational and historical episode about the top 10 firearms that really shaped America. We hope you enjoyed it. We'll catch you on the next one.